Okay, so I want to give you a little bit more introductory information that's more specific for the lab. And then I'll get on to the biology part. Today, though, is unusual for a few reasons, more than a few, actually. One is that this is the only time when you should not expect to have a quiz. I think I talked about this a little bit in lecture, but starting a little bit less than a week from now, because we're a few seconds into the day, very beginning of next lab, you should expect the quiz to start right exactly at 2:30. And that's important because there's a stiff lateness penalty. Just like the stiff lateness penalty for the lecture points that you get for being there, you'll get penalized for the quiz that starts at 2:30 if you are late at all. And so if it's 2:30 and some number of seconds, that's 10%. 2:31 up to 2:32 is 20%, and so on. 10 minutes late, obviously that's 100% off, so you lose the entire quiz. So, as I was saying before, don't let that happen. That's a foolish way to lose points. Okay? So it shouldn't be a problem because we have lecture first, so you're already here. You know, you can't blame traffic or anything. You should be here on time. So that's one reason when we don't have a quiz today. Another reason that it's unusual is that compared to all the other days, I'll be talking a hell of a lot more today than I usually do. In fact, that's all we're doing. You're listening to me. We're not using this equipment. We're not doing a procedure. It's just a lecture today. Another reason that it's unusual is that even though there is a so-called pre-lab for this, it's obviously not a pre-lab because you didn't know about it before you showed up today. So you still have some points that you need to get for today's lab, but obviously it's a post-lab rather than a pre-lab. And I will actually make an announcement about that maybe tomorrow morning on my website. Not only is it unusual because it's after the lab rather than before, but because it's the only one that you will not do on Canvas. So you'll actually be handing in paper for the metric system one, which is the first so-called pre-lab. Okay? From now on, though, the night before, at the latest, midnight the night before, you have to, by then, have the pre-lab for the next day done. This is a way of forcing you to read ahead so you don't come in here totally clueless about what you're doing, which is a pain in the ass for your group members, right? If only one person knows what's going on, that hurts. So that's why we have pre-labs, but they're also a nice batch of points that are easy to get to make up for some harder assignments. Just do what is necessary to remind yourself to remember those pre-labs, though, because I see it happen every term that people just, I don't think they intentionally blow them off, they just forget. Yeah.
So the quizzes, are they going to be like on what we lectured on?
No, the only thing you're ever tested for on the lectures upstairs are the lecture examinations that I talked about up there. All the lab stuff has to do with what we're doing in here. So there's different categories of lab points. And I went through them already on the syllabus, but a lot of those had to do with lab. One batch of points is the pre-labs I just talked about. Okay, so don't forget those have to be done not after midnight, before midnight the day before. You also, though, have a quiz, which I just told you starts promptly at 2:30, so don't get a penalty for showing up after 2:30. And those will be projected, the questions will be projected, and you're just writing your answers. So get here no later than 2:28, let's say, to get yourself situated before we take the quiz. Those quizzes are almost entirely about what you did the previous week. Okay? So to prepare for them, you need to listen to each previous week's recording. So I'll make a recording in here too, Today's will be long, but usually I'll just have a few minutes of saying whatever to get you started. However much I say on each week's recording, it's important to study that recording as a way of preparing for the upcoming quiz the next week. Okay? That's almost all of the questions, and the number of questions isn't constant. It's roughly 8 questions per quiz. Usually takes the first 10 minutes of the lab. But almost all, if not all, of those questions will be about the previous week's material. There might be 1 or 2 questions, though, about what you're doing that day. So that's another reason why you need to read ahead and know what you're doing coming in through the door to do well on the quizzes. The quizzes, as opposed to the pre-labs, are going to be much lower scores if you're a typical class. And I've taught it enough times that I know exactly what's going to happen. And probably the worst of those quizzes will be the first one coming up next week. And I think that's probably because it's the only one that involves math, which throws a lot of people for whatever reason. But if you bomb the first quiz, I don't want you to, but if you do, don't panic. It happens to a lot of people and still works out. It can still work out. But that's an immediate stark lesson on how much you have to prepare day by day for this course. Okay, if you prepare yourself well based on what I say today, you don't have to bomb this first one. I just know what happens usually. So that's we have pre-labs, that's a batch of lab points. The actual quizzes, that's a batch. The connect points are not really lab points. But we have the 3 lab reports, and I'll talk individually about those because they're all different, all based on different procedures. Once we get to the first procedure, I'll talk about that first one. And they're no big deal. They're not real long, drawn-out lab reports. So don't worry about that. And then you have the practicum at the end. Now, I don't want you to totally forget the practicum. I just want you to realize that it's not okay after you do the quiz to forget about the stuff from the previous week. You need to know it for the sake of the quiz, but you also need to keep it all of the week's material in your mind for the practicum, because the practicum is cumulative for the entire term. Now, you don't have to know every tiny detail. You know, you're not going to memorize data or anything like that, but you have to know the major concepts. And it can be tempting not to bother to learn them because you're not going to be handing things in other than the quiz when you complete each week's procedures. You're doing them to learn the stuff, and you're taking notes in the laboratory manuals that you'll eventually have once they become available, but you're not handing that stuff in to me. The stuff that you do and write down in the lab manual is for your own study, okay? So that helps you for the quizzes, but it also, when it comes time to the end of the term, if you're still around, you need to go back through that and study each week's material to learn the basics of that to do well on the practicum. And I think that's it for the lab points. Yeah, should be. Any questions on that? Does Canvas have a safety thing that you had to complete? It does? Okay, so that's why we don't have a sign-in sheet anymore. So that's, I don't have to worry about that. Safety is pretty much common sense. But you should know where the... Don't we have a fire extinguisher in here? Well, there's where the eye wash station is in the shower and... It's pretty much common sense, but definitely do that online thing. That brings us to the topic, well, the topics. And like I said, this is going to be a much longer lecture than I usually give in the laboratory. But no matter how much or little I talk about each lab, you should treat it for what it is. It's a lecture, so you should be taking notes. You do have the recording, but you should also be taking notes if you really want to do well along the way, and asking questions. If you, you know, I often say, does that make sense or do you understand? I don't do that just as a nervous tick. I'm genuinely asking you whether it makes sense. So don't, if it doesn't make sense, don't be afraid to tell me. A lot of students are afraid to ask questions because it seems embarrassing not to know something. But think about it, that's pretty silly. If you knew the stuff already, why would you be taking the class? You should be teaching it instead. Okay. I want to go over some scientific fundamentals today, starting with, as you see on the slide, quantities and units. Now, who wants to define what a quantity is? Yeah. Yes, it is an amount, or the way I would say it is it's basically anything that you can measure. And so, with that broad definition, there's really no limit to the number of different quantities there are in the universe. What's an example of a quantity? What's something that you can measure? There's no limit to the answer, so this shouldn't be too much of a struggle. What?
Weight.
Weight is a good example of a quantity. How is that different from unit? What's the difference between quantity and unit? Or what is a unit?
It's like, so you can see how much there is of something, and then the unit is the, I guess it's like a definition of how much there is of that stuff.
Yeah, units are standardized increments in which we measure quantities. So you have all kinds of different quantities. That's just anything you can measure. What you measure them in are units. And for any given quantity, there's typically many different units you can choose from. So the example quantity you gave me was weight. But what are some corresponding units? What are some units of weight? Pounds? Not grams. I'm glad you said that, but this brings up an important distinction. And in fact, a lot of people who should know better, instructors basically, get this wrong. I hear it wrong on TV all the time too. A gram is a unit, but it's not a unit of weight. It's a unit of mass. Mass and weight are two totally different quantities. They're not just different names for the same thing. Mass, by the way, roughly speaking, is the amount of matter contained in a sample. How much matter it's made up of. Weight is related and depends on mass, but it's not the amount of stuff. Weight is a force. It's an example of a force. And specifically, weight is the force due to gravity. So anything that is massive, which by which I mean not big, we use the word massive to mean big, but massive scientifically simply means it has mass, some amount of mass. It's made of matter. Massive objects exert gravitational force on each other. So your weight is the force that you're exerting on the Earth's surface by standing on it, by the gravitational attraction. Earth is attracting you as well. The distinction here is, let me give you something that actually pisses me off a little bit. In the two things that piss me off. One is that, embarrassingly, the United States is one of only three remaining countries who don't use the metric system in everyday life. Almost the entire world does, except for the United States, Liberia, and Myanmar, I think, are the three. And even in the United States, the scientists use the metric system. The metric system all scientists throughout the world use, which is a much easier and sane system than the silly system the United States uses still. By the way, to make this an even longer story, we're in 2022 now, so it was 48 years ago when I was in fifth grade, and I remember the teacher one day saying, "We're going to learn the metric system today, so make sure you pay attention, because pretty soon that's all we'll be using here in the United States." Almost 50 years later, and we're not close to using the metric system, which is a shame for various reasons, including that we don't even teach the silly system completely. You probably don't even know the whole English system. For instance, speaking of mass, what is the silly system unit for mass? Anyone know this? See what I'm saying? We don't even teach the system we use. The silly system unit of mass is the slug, which used to be used by engineers in this country, but now it's all metric, grams. But to further explain the distinction between mass and weight, it's useful to think about going out into space, which a lot of people have done, right? Well, the mass is that you as have as a person is the amount of matter your body's made up of. If you go out into space, that doesn't change, right? You still have the same mass, but you're no longer attracted by the Earth when you get far enough. So you go into weightlessness. Your weight goes down to zero, but your mass stays the same. Well, back to one of the things another thing that pisses me off, besides the fact that we don't use the metric system. You know, most of the bathroom scales made in the world, you have one scale, but ones that are made for use in the United States usually have two. They have a row of big numbers and then smaller numbers below it, right? What are the big numbers units? Pounds. And that's correct, assuming you want to use the silly system, which we do. Because that's what you're directly measuring, right? When you stand on a bathroom scale, you're pushing down on the springs with your weight. So you should be measuring weight, and therefore it should be reading in units of weight, which pounds are. But the smaller number on a typical scale shows you what units? Kilograms, which are not units of weight. They are units of mass. Now, if you take that bathroom scale to the moon with you, your mass is not going to change, right? But that bathroom scale will say you're a lot fewer kilograms, even though you're not. Your weight will still be correct because you'll have 1/5 of the gravitational attraction, and therefore you'll weigh 1/6 as much, but the scale will still be correct, right? But the scale, if you read it as kilograms, will be wrong because you didn't lose that mass, you just you're not exerting as much weight anymore. By the way, if it were correct and you had the metric equivalent, meaning the metric unit of weight instead of mass, what would those units be? What is the metric unit of weight? Grams is mass, not weight. But what is weight? Or any force, actually. All weights are forces. Not all forces are weights, but weight is just a special force due to gravitation. Anyone know? Who is it that told us about gravity? Newton. And so in his honor, the metric unit of weight is the Newton, or of any force, not just weight. So it really should be pounds on the top, newtons on the bottom, but it's not. And the reason that they get away with that is that they make the, I admit, fairly reasonable assumption that you're only going to ever use that bathroom scale on the surface of the Earth, in which case you can assume that the mass and the weight go hand in hand because of Earth's gravity. Anyway, those we mentioned a few different quantities so far, and any given quantity has corresponding units, right? So there are these two categories right away, quantities and units. Do you have a good feel for the difference between those two? Okay. Let's dig a little deeper then and say that there are two categories for each of these categories. There's two major categories of quantities and correspondingly two major categories of units. And the two kinds or categories of quantities are fundamental quantities and derived quantities. And although there's no limit to the number of quantities, because you can measure a hell of a lot of things, there's actually a very small number of fundamental quantities. Surprisingly few, like only like 9. Can't remember exactly the number. But what's the difference here? Well, I usually use chemistry as an analogy here. There are only roughly 100 elements or types of atoms, right, on the periodic table. Makes up the entire universe. There's all kinds of different chemicals, right? But they're made of molecules that are made out of multiple atoms, right? So molecules are like derived quantities compared to fundamental, whereas atoms are like the fundamental quantities. Another way of saying it more directly is that a derived quantity is any quantity that actually is made up of two or more quantities. Just like, you know, if you think of an oxygen molecule, both of the atoms are oxygen, so it's not even two different kinds of atoms. But the fact that you have two atoms rather than just one makes it a molecule. A fundamental quantity is a quantity that is not made up of other quantities. It stands on its own. And that's why there are so few of them. So the vast majority of quantities are derived. They're made up of fundamental quantities, some number of fundamental quantities. Can you think of a fundamental quantity on that short list? What is it? An atom is an object. It's not a quantity. So think about something that you measure. Right, so far we've talked about, what was your example? Weight? That's a quantity, right? Something you measure. Well, is weight fundamental or derived? Well, speaking of Newton, what famous equation did he give us for force? F equals what? F equals ma. Force equals mass times acceleration. So force, which is a quantity, weight is force, you can see by that equation that it's a quantity that's actually made up of other quantities. So it's a derived quantity, forces and weight. In fact, mass itself, I mean acceleration itself, just the A, is derived itself. It doesn't stand on its own. But mass is an example of a fundamental quantity. Mass is not made up of other quantities. Can you think of another fundamental one? What are things that you measure?
Heat.
Did you say heat?
Or temperature.
Well, heat and temperature are different.
Right.
They're also related, like mass and weight are. Heat is is a form of energy. Temperature is a measure of the average speed of the particles of a sample. And temperature is an example of a fundamental quantity. It's one of the short list. Any other guesses for fundamental? Width is an example, but there's many words that we use for the same quantity. Width is really just another name for distance, right? Length, width, height, they really are all distances. And distance, by the way, is a fundamental quantity. Now, whatever the quantity is, meaning if it's fundamental or derived, any unit of that quantity is either fundamental or derived based on what the quantity is. So you have a lot of choices for units of mass, for instance. I just told you slug and gram, right? Since mass is a fundamental quantity, any unit you use for mass is also a fundamental unit. And correspondingly, if you have a derived quantity, any unit you use for that derived quantity is going to be a derived unit. Is that all clear? The one that I'm surprised no one came up with, another fundamental one, is time. Time is not made up of other quantities. It stands on its own. Well, speaking of fundamental and derived, let's look at a list of some important quantities in the next slide. Time, I just mentioned that it's fundamental. All kinds of choices for units, right? By the way, this is the one place where the silly system and the metric system combine. They overlap. We use seconds, minutes, and hours in both the silly and the metric system. And it's really the only exception in the metric system in that it's not decimal. It's not based on tens. So it's based on 60s, right, instead. But hours, minutes, and seconds are units of both metric and silly system. And since time is a derived quantity, hours and minutes and seconds are derived, fundamental quantity, hours, minutes, and seconds are fundamental units. Same with mass. Also fundamental, and same with length, as I said, or distance, same thing. What about volume? We didn't talk about volume. Fundamental or derived? Why is it derived? Length times width is area. If you're measuring, if you're trying to calculate the volume of a cube, for instance, it's not just length times width. Length times width times height, which are really just three different words for distance, right? Or length. And so this is exactly what I was talking about with the oxygen molecule example. To be derived, it doesn't have to be different types of quantities it's made up of, just two or more. In this case, it's three quantities, but they're all length, right? Length times length times length. We call them length, width, and height, but they're all lengths. As long as it's two or more, that makes it derived. So, volume is a derived quantity, and any unit that you choose, whether it's teaspoons, cubic centimeters, acre feet, whatever, those are correspondingly derived units because the quantity is derived. Yeah.
Time
is fundamental.
Why again?
Because it's not made up of other quantities. It stands on its own. Force, I've already talked about, it is, which includes all weight. That's derived because it's made up of other quantities, mass and acceleration. Acceleration, I told you earlier, it was already by itself derived because acceleration is distance per time. So it's made up of not only multiple quantities, but multiple different types of quantities. Temperature, I told you already, is fundamental, and so is number of particles. The particles can be anything you're counting, but how many there are, that's fundamental. It's not made up of other things. By the way, there's different units we can use for number of particles. For instance, dozen, right? A dozen is just a number. If I say I'm going to give you a dozen, you have no idea what I'm going to give you, right? You just know that I'm going to give you 12 of them. Could be planets, eggs, whatever. In chemistry and biology, we often deal with almost unimaginably small particles when we're counting them, atoms and molecules, or ions, and therefore a dozen isn't a convenient size in which to count things. When you have very tiny things like atoms and molecules, it takes a hell of a lot of them just to have enough to be barely visible. So we count them with big units. What is the unit I'm talking about when we're talking about number of molecules or number of atoms? Anyone know? It's the mole. Which has a value it's also called Avogadro's number. Have you heard about Avogadro's number? Do you know the value for it? Well, I mean, what's the numerical value? Like, dozen is not 13, it's not 11, it's 12 exactly. And only 12. Well, when we say a mole, that's just like saying a dozen by itself. It can be a mole of anything, depending on what you're counting. But what does mole equal to? Equal. Like dozen equals 12, mole equals what? Avogadro's number, which is 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd power. A really, really big number, right? Wouldn't be convenient to use that if you're counting beans, but if you're counting particles that are so tiny they're invisible until you get a lot of them together, it's appropriate. That's a fundamental... number of particles is a fundamental quantity. The mole is therefore a fundamental unit. By the way, speaking of temperature, a little bit before that, there's all kinds of temperature scales that have been devised over the millennia. But there's really only three that we really have in use still today, or in wide use. What do we use in the Silly system? The Fahrenheit scale, and what are the units called? The units of Fahrenheit temperature. Degrees Fahrenheit. Which as a symbol is the little circle, right? But you have to put an F to show that it's degrees Fahrenheit. What's another system that we still use? Temperature scale. Celsius or centigrade, which also has degrees as units, right? That's why you don't just write a degree symbol, you write degree C or degree F. Celsius is the more modern term, but centigrade means the same thing, it refers to the same scale. I think it's a better word because centigrade literally means 100 tick marks. Specifically, there are 100 tick marks between the temperature at which water, which it's based on, boils, which is at 100 C by definition, 100 tick marks between that and 0 centigrade, which is the temperature at which water freezes. Okay? And between 0 and 100, there's 100 gradations, or centigrade. Well, obviously water will freeze on the and boil in the, on the Fahrenheit scale as well. What are the corresponding temperatures? It boils at what? Water, that is. In the scale that you grew up with, what is the boiling point of water? So this is why we should scrap the whole thing. 212 degrees Fahrenheit. Water boils. What about freezing? Same temperature as zero centigrade is what Fahrenheit? What is it? I can't hear. Freezing point of water. 32, yes. And so notice that between 32 and 212, there's 180 tick marks. And this is why, by the way, when you convert between centigrade and Fahrenheit, it involves a 1.8 conversion factor. Because 180 divided by 100 is 1.8. What's the third still widely used temperature scale? The Kelvin scale, otherwise called the absolute temperature scale. And centigrade is metric, well, so is Kelvin. So we use both in the metric system. What are the units on the Kelvin scale? They are not degrees Kelvin. They are called Kelvins. So don't use the degree symbol. Just use K, uppercase K. Not only are the Kelvin and centigrade scales both metric, but they also have exactly the same size units. So one Kelvin is exactly the same size as 1 degree centigrade. There's 100 tick marks between boiling and freezing in Kelvin, just like there is in centigrade. But they're different numbers because, unlike the centigrade scale, which you can go below zero on, you can't go below zero on the Kelvin scale. That's why it's called absolute zero. Think back to a few minutes ago when I said what temperature is. It's an indication of the average speed of the particles, right? The slower, you know, every particle is moving at its own speed, but you can take the average of the population of particles, and whatever that is, that's the temperature. Well, there's a lower limit to that, right? The colder something is, the slower the particles are moving on average. Eventually, none of the particles are moving at all, that's as slow as they can get, right? You have negative speed. So that's why there is an absolute zero, the coldest anything can be, which is not 0 degrees Kelvin, just 0 Kelvin. But each tick mark, each unit is the same size in Kelvin and centigrade. It's just that absolute zero is equal to roughly negative 273.15 centigrade. Which means room temperature, which is about 30 degrees centigrade, is roughly 300 Kelvins. That's what we're living in right now, 300 Kelvins. Okay, so those are examples, but are you confident in your ability to tell the difference between a quantity and a unit on the one hand, and more specifically between a fundamental quantity and fundamental unit on the one hand, and a derived quantity and derived unit on the other hand? Yeah. A derived quantity, did you say?
Yeah.
A derived quantity is a quantity that's made up of two or more quantities. Time is not like that, right? But area, which is actually what you gave me when you said length times width, is made up of length and width. That's two quantities it's made up of. So therefore, area is derived.
Right. Did you say that there was derived in fundamental units, though?
Oh, yes. What I said is that start with the quantity, because units correspond to quantities, right? If you know that the quantity is derived, then any units you use that are valid for that quantity are also derived units. If you know that it's a fundamental quantity, then the units you use for that are all fundamental units. All right, go ahead. Fundamental means that it's not made up of other quantities. It is its own quantity. And that's why I was saying it's kind of like atoms compared to molecules. Molecules are made up of atoms. They don't stand on their own. And it doesn't have to even be different types of atoms, like an oxygen molecule. It's just that there's two or more of them. That makes it derived. Okay, let's go to this next slide. Talk about the metric system. The metric, by the way, simply means measurement. Meter means measure. But the metric system, the heart of the easiness of the metric system compared to the silly system is that it's a decimal system. So it's all based on powers of 10, which are nice for humans because we have 10 digits. That's why we think 10 is a special number, because we grow up with it. But this chart lists, by rows, important prefaces or prefixes that the metric system uses for its units. Now, no unit is shown here. The unit that you use depends on the quantity you're measuring, right? So, for instance, if you're using seconds, I mean, if you're using time, if you're measuring time, then you should be using units of time, which could be seconds, minutes, hours. If you're measuring mass, you should be using grams, right? So your choice of metric unit depends on the quantity that you're measuring. That's why no individual unit is shown here. But there's not just one unit that is the right size unit to use for all situations. For instance, if you're cooking a recipe, it wouldn't be appropriate to say add 5 millionths of a ton of flour, right? A ton is not an appropriate unit to be using for an at-home recipe. It's too big a unit, right? So you use things like teaspoons or whatever. Similarly, in the metric system, whatever the quantity is, there's a corresponding base unit. So, for instance, for time, the base unit is the second. For mass, the base unit is the gram. For force, the base unit is the newton, as I said, and so on. The base on this table is represented by the middle row. And nothing is listed there as a prefix, because if we're using that base unit, we don't use a prefix. For instance, if we're measuring something in grams, it's just grams. Not kilograms or centigrams, just grams. But if that's an inappropriately small unit to be using for your situation, you might want bigger units to use to make it easier to express the numbers, then you have a lot of choices within the metric system. That's what the rows above the base are about. Now, before we get to those, notice that I said it's all based on powers of 10. The base has a magnitude of 10 to the 0 power. Well, what 10 to the 0, or anything other than 0, raised to the 0 power is equal to 1, right? Multiplying by something by 1 doesn't change it. It keeps it as it is. So that's the base. Each row above a row is a unit that is 3 orders of magnitude bigger than the row below it. But what does it mean to be an order of magnitude? Well, An order of magnitude is 10 times, or 10 to the 1. 3 orders of magnitude is 10 to the 3rd power, which is 1,000, right? So that's why you go from 10 to the 0 at the base to 10 to the 3rd. The row above that is 10 to the 6th, which is 3 orders of magnitude bigger than 10 to the 3rd. But compared to the base, it's 6 orders of magnitude bigger. 1,000,000 times bigger than the base. Okay? Look at the names of the prefixes. Every one of them except one above the middle base row starts with a capital letter, and the symbol is a capital letter. Because we usually don't spell them out, we use the symbol more often. That's not by accident. The reason that these are big, are capital numbers is to remind you that this is a prefix that is bigger than the base. It's a unit that's bigger than the base, not smaller. So we use capital letters. Except for kilo, which means 10 to the 3rd, or 1,000 times as big. Why don't we use capital K? And keep it consistent with all the others. Yeah. Right, we already have K being used to mean kelvins, so it would be ambiguous. All of the ones below the base are smaller than the base. And each one below is 1/1,000th as big as the one above it. And therefore, they all use lowercase letters to remind you that they're small. So a milli-whatever is only 1/1,000th the size of the base. And by the way, we never use these prefixes in isolation. You never say, I mean, you do in slang, but in science, you don't say a kilo or a milli. That's not a unit, right? That's just a multiplier. So you say a kilogram or a kilowatt or a millimeter. Okay, it just depends. That's why they all end in a dash. It's just a prefix. But you put that prefix in front of whatever unit is appropriate for the quantity you're measuring. Does that all make sense? And tell me if it doesn't. Okay. So milli and micro are two units that are smaller than the base. For instance, a milligram is only 1/1,000th of a gram, 10 to the negative third, not positive third. 10 to the negative third, by the way, is the same as 1 over 10 to the third, which is the same as 1 over 1,000, which is the same as 1/1,000th of, right? Anyway, milli is 1/1,000th of the base. Micro is 1/1,000th of a milli, which means it's 1/1,000,000th of the base. 3 orders of magnitude difference each step. There's another problem here. They both start with M, right? So we can't use lowercase m for both of them. That would be ambiguous. You wouldn't know what the hell you're measuring. Well, we use an m for milli. We never use m by itself, by the way, except when we mean meter. The M, the symbol M for meaning milli, has to come before the symbol for the unit itself. So millimeters, mm. Milliliters, ml. But lowercase if it's milli. If it's capital ML, then that's megaliters, which means 1,000,000 liters, not 1/1,000,000th of a liter. Anyway, back to this M problem. They both start with M, so you can't use M for both. You use it for milli. For the micro, you use this symbol. What is that? It kind of looks like an upside down and backwards H, but it actually is a Greek letter. The Greek version of M, which is the mu, spelled M-U. But it is not a U. Some people will type it in like this, which a word processor will give you if you hit the U key. That's not a mu. You can get Word or any other word processor to type a mu for you if you use symbols. But this is not how a mew looks. A mew has a beginning tail that's lower than the rest of it. That's a mew. And so it's just the Greek version of M. It's another way of saying M without being confusing it with Millie. Okay? The others, though, are just pretty straightforward. N for nano, and so on. So this whole range is enormous on this whole table. It goes up to 10 to the 24th power. Very unbelievably big number. And down 10 to 10 to the negative 24th. Amazingly small number. So that's enough between those two extremes for all real situations. In fact, in biology, we don't need nearly that whole range. So we wouldn't use the ones on the top, we wouldn't use the ones on the bottom, and therefore I'm not demanding that you learn all of those. That's why I made a special table on the next slide, eliminating some. The red ones you can forget about, at least for this class. They're too big or too large to be of use in biology. The white ones you have to know, and they were there in that previous table. The yellow ones have been added. They weren't in the previous table. Remember in the previous table, every step was 3 orders of magnitude change? Well, just above the base and just below the base, it's sometimes convenient to make just 1 order of magnitude steps. In other words, a jump of just 10 rather than 1,000. And so that's what these yellow ones are, which you should also know. So deca, be careful with that. Don't confuse it with deci with a C. Deca with a K and DA as the symbol means 10 times bigger than the base. So a $10 bill is a decadollar. It's one decadollar, right? Whereas a decidollar would be a dime. It's one-tenth of a dollar. And hecto means 100 of, so it's bigger than the base. Centi is 1/100th of, and that's why we call a penny a cent. It's 1/100th of a dollar. In other words, a penny is a cent a dollar. Okay, now, so know all the white ones and the yellow ones. You use these prefixes, though, over and over with all of the various units. You just make the choice of unit based on what quantity you're measuring. Right? Is that all clear? Okay. Then that brings us to another major topic, which is something that's called dimensional analysis. Important thing in science that's used for various reasons, but we're really going to use dimensional analysis for one reason, and it's an important reason, which is for the purpose of conversion. You use it in conversion problems. And dimensional analysis is something that most students try any way they can to not do correctly for whatever reason. But you should bother to do it correctly, not just because I'm telling you that, but because you want to get full credit on quiz questions, I assume, if you want to maximize your score. There's more important reasons, though. It's the reason that you should go through with the proper steps is so that you can tell that you're doing this correctly. Dimension is another word for unit. So this whole process is called dimensional analysis because you're dealing with units. And that's the part that students want to skip traditionally. They're used to just entering numbers into a calculator because you don't enter any units into a calculator, right? So all they want to bother with are the numbers. But if you ignore the units, you can easily go wrong. And you'll even if you get the right magnitude, which is the numerical value of an answer, you'll still not get credit if I'm asking you to do proper dimensional analysis, which includes all the units as well. All right? So do it this way. I've given you an example conversion problem here. How many millimeters are in 150 miles? Okay, so first of all, what is the quantity? That we're dealing with here. No, that's a unit. That's a magnitude. That's a unit. Remember, you told me that you had a good feel for the difference between units and quantities. What is a quantity in general? What's the definition of a quantity? What did I say it is? Something you measure. What's being measured here?
Length
or distance. Same thing. Yeah, that's the quantity, right? Now, the quantity is not changing. That's important here. You have a certain quantity. That's not going to change in a conversion problem. All you're doing is converting from one unit for that quantity to another unit of that same quantity. So you have a certain distance. That's the quantity. That distance is not going to change, okay? Quantity doesn't change, the units do. But a conversion problem using dimensional analysis is really, mathematically speaking, serial multiplication, meaning you're multiplying something by something else, by something else, by something else, until you're done. Now, in math, what do we call things that get multiplied together? A product is the answer. I'm talking about the things that are actually multiplied. Like 3 times 2, what is 3 and what is 2 an example of? What do we call the things that get multiplied together? No, they're constants, but if you're multiplying them, they're called factors. If you're adding them together, they're called addends. But here we're multiplying, so they're called factors. All right? Everything in parentheses here individually is a factor. This first one is special, though, because it is simply what we're given in the problem. It's an expression of the quantity, the distance, right? It's 150 miles that came straight from what was given in the problem. All the other ones under the bracket are also factors, but these are conversion factors. Now remember, I said that the quantity isn't going to change, the distance doesn't change, but you're going to multiply that distance over and over by factors. Well, if the distance isn't going to change, what is the only thing that you can multiply it by for it not to change? One. Exactly. It's the multiplicative identity, right? You multiply something by one, you get the same thing back. In other words, the distance won't change if you just keep multiplying it by one. Does that make sense? Well, one is not the only way you can represent one. Each of these conversion factors is just another way of saying one. And therefore, if you have the original quantity and you just keep multiplying by one, you end up with the same quantity. Okay, that's mathematically the explanation. But think about different representations of one. All of these conversion factors happen to be fractions, right? If I tell you that a fraction is equal to 1, what do you know about that fraction? Without even looking at it. What is true of any fraction that equals 1? Well, yeah, that's another way of saying it's 1. But what has to be true of the fraction for it to equal 1? Yes, the numerator has to be the same as the denominator, right? In other words, 4/4 is just another name for 1. 17/17 is another name for 1. Every conversion factor here individually has a numerator that's equal to the denominator. It's just expressing the same quantity in different units. But they equal each other as quantities. Does that make sense? The numerator and the denominator. And that's why if you just keep multiplying by ones, you're left with the same distance, but you're now expressing it in different units. That's what conversion is, and that's what dimensional analysis is for. So think about this as a process that you should do it in exactly these steps. The first step is to just make, to slap down what the problem is giving you. In this case, it's 150 miles. That's the starting point. Now, the conversion factors are all fractions. 150 miles is not a fraction, but I can easily make it into a fraction like the others just by putting it over 1. You don't really have to do that. I like to look at it better as all fractions. Okay, so that's where this comes from. This is the starting point. But importantly, it's not just 150 over 1. It's 150 miles. That's what students are reluctant to do. They don't want to put down the units. And if you don't put down the units, you can't be convinced that you've set it up properly. Okay, not only will you not get credit, but you won't know whether you've set the problem up correctly. So always put the units. Now, that's my quantity, but it's in the wrong units. So I need to multiply it by a conversion factor to put that same quantity into other units. I could use any conversion factor I want that's valid. And if I had a conversion factor that made me in one step go from miles to millimeters, which is what I'm aiming for, then I would be done in one step. But I don't have one of those memorized. So I have to work with what I already have on hand. But I'm going to rewrite it onto the side so you can more see the process. Always start the same way. Write down what you're given. In this case, it's 150 miles. I'm going to make it a fraction by putting it over 1. That's the starting point. Now, automatically, the next step should just be to make an empty fraction beside it. Don't worry about any numbers yet. Play with units first. The problem at this point is that we're in miles, right? We can't be in miles to obey the question. How do you get rid of units in fractions? How do they cancel out? If one is in the numerator and the other is in the denominator, right? Well, miles is right now in the numerator. So automatically put miles in this empty fraction in the bottom. That way it's going to cancel out. Now you need to put a unit in the top. And like I said, it can be anything that you know is the conversion factor for. Well, maybe you didn't memorize any of these, but did you learn 5,280 feet per mile? So this is the problem with the silly system, has all these different numbers you have to memorize. Maybe you learned that. Maybe you learned 1,760 yards per mile, which is the one I'm using here. Okay? If you were to stop there, you would have the same quantity, because this is really 150 times 1, right? But now your answer would be in yards instead of miles. That's why you know you're not done, and that's why you bother to write the units down, to know when you're done. By the way, this, in any individual conversion factor, the numerator and the denominator are really equal to each other, but they're in different units, right? So that they have they're different sizes of units. Well, hopefully it makes sense to you that the smaller the units are that you use, the more you're going to require for that quantity compared to a larger unit, right? It's like the old joke, if someone's making you a pizza and asks you, do you want that cut into 6 or 8 slices? And the dude says, you better make it 8, I'm really hungry today. You're not really getting any more pizza, right? But you're making smaller units, and therefore there are more of them for that quantity. So in any given conversion factor, one unit will be bigger than the other. Whether it's up or down depends, but one will be bigger than the other. Whatever the smaller one is will have the bigger number because they actually equal each other in quantity. You see what I'm saying there? Yards are much smaller than miles, so it's not surprising that there's a lot of them to equal 1 mile. Okay, can't stop there because we're in yards. So we just continue this process of making a blank fraction. Now we know we need to get rid of the yards, so you just automatically put yards in the opposite place. In this case, it's down. You can go to whatever you want. In this case, I used the commonly memorized 3 feet per 1 yard. Cancels out my yards, but I'm in feet now, which is still not done. So I continue that process. Get rid of the feet, go to inches. Probably have memorized that there are 12 inches in 1 foot. Once again, the smaller unit has the bigger number compared to the bigger unit. Okay, now, all along here, we've been staying in the silly system. This happens to be a problem in which we're trying to get from the silly system to the metric system. And there's a special conversion factor that you should bother to memorize that's useful for converting between English and metric distances or the other way. And that's the one between centimeters and inches, which is coming up next because now I need to get rid of the inches, right? And the reason this is a special one that you should bother to memorize is that it's exact. It is not an approximation. There are exactly 2.54 centimeters in 1 inch. By exactly, I mean you can write that as 2.54 or 2.540 or 2.54, as many zeros as you want. It's exact, just like 12 is exactly a dozen, right? It's 12.000000. Well, this is now where we have made the step from silly to metric, because now we're in centimeters. Now, one nice thing about the metric system is that you can easily go from anywhere in the metric system to anywhere else. And once you get used to the metric system, I recommend doing that. But don't do that now if you're just learning this. Instead, if you are in the metric system, but you need to be somewhere else in the metric system, which we need to get to millimeters, instead of going directly from centimeters to millimeters, temporarily go from where you are at the moment in the metric system, which is centimeters, to the base unit, whatever it is. In this case, it's meters. That way, you can use what you've memorized the values of these prefixes to be, which are all based on the base. Right? Centi means 1/100th of. So it takes 100 of them as the smaller unit to equal 1 of the base. Is that clear? Now, if you tried to do that from centimeters to decimeters, it's easy once you're used to it, but you're going to get confused about what the prefixes mean. So do it my way. Go to the base temporarily, and then once you're at the base, you can go from the base to where you need to be in the metric system, which in this case is millimeters. Now, once again, you can use your memorized value for milli, which is 1/1000th of, to know that the smaller unit has 1,000 of them to equal 1 meter. Now, we're not done, but we're done setting it up. And unless you bother to write those units down, you won't know whether you've set this up right. It's very easy to flip one of these upside down if you're only using numbers. And if you do that, you're going to get a totally incorrect magnitude or value for your answer. Not only that, you know you're done now because everything has canceled except the unit that the question is asking for. Okay? So do it that way. It'll help you in other courses as well if you do it correctly. So we know we're done with the setup. It's now a matter of actually getting the value, the magnitude. Now, you'll be using a calculator in most cases when you do these. A common mistake with calculators is using equals more than once within the same problem. And that can lead to errors. What we have here is nothing but multiplication and division, right? There's no addition or subtraction. Multiplication and division are equal in the hierarchy of mathematical operations, which is just another way of saying that they can be done in any order and you'll still get the same answer. So, for instance, you could enter this as 12 divided by 1 times, divided by 100 times 1,000. You could do it in any order you want, as long as you're multiplying for any top number and dividing for any bottom number. But why would you do it randomly? It makes sense to just do it straight across. So this times this, times this, times this, times this, times this, times this, divided by this, divided by this, divided by this, and so on, and then hit equals one time at the end. And by the way, you don't have to bother with the ones, either on the top or the bottom, because they won't change the value. Okay, so really what you would do is 150 times 1760 times 3 times 12 times 2.54 times 1,000 divided by 100 equals. That's the proper way to do it, and that way you'll have the correct magnitude. Now the magnitude is just the numerical part of the answer. It's another common mistake is to just write the magnitude. That's not the answer, right? The full answer is the magnitude and the units, if it has units. Not everything has units, but most things do. Okay? Now, if you do this, the calculator is going to spit out a long number. Because the calculator doesn't know anything about significant figures. But significant figures are important in science because you can't claim that you have more resolution, your ability to tell the difference between things, than you actually have. So your answer can't have more significant figures in it than whatever number had that you used along the way that has the smallest number of significant figures. This is why I made a point to say that 2.54 is exact. This doesn't have three significant figures, it has infinite. Because you can add as many significant zeros as you want to the end of that. It's typically the measurement itself that is the constraining thing here. That's 150 miles. So, this actually brings up a little side topic about significant figures. How many significant figures does 150 have? 150. No, it would have infinite if we knew that it was exactly 150. This is a measurement, though. And all measurements have some uncertainty. So we don't know that it's exactly 150. Now, this is kind of a trick question asking you how many, because this is an ambiguous number because of the trailing zero. We know that it has at least two, because the one is significant and the five is significant. The zero is ambiguous. Okay? So it's either two or three. And really, I should have written 150 point. Because if there's a point after a zero, that makes that zero significant. So let's say that it's 150 point instead of just 150. Well, 150 with a decimal point after it has exactly three significant figures. Therefore, whatever your answer ends up being according to the calculator has to be rounded to only three significant figures. You can't have more in your answer. And that's why I rounded here. See, the calculator would spit out 241401600. Well, you don't really have the ability to know it to that fine a detail. You only have three. So you have to round it at this one place. Since four is less than five, you keep it as one. So it's 241 million, right? Millimeters. But if we express that in scientific notation rather than standard notation, it's 2.41 times 10 to the 8th millimeters. So make sure your answer is not just a number, not a magnitude by itself. It's a magnitude with the units. And let me talk a little bit more now about significant figures. I mean about standard versus scientific notation. Standard notation is just a number by itself that you're familiar with in everyday life. Like 12. Standard notation. Scientific notation expresses whatever the number is as a number times 10 to some power. In this case, 1.2 times 10 to the first. Because it takes one, the decimal point is right here at first. It takes one step to get it there between the one and the two, so it's 10 to the first. Well, why do we do this? Why do we use scientific notation? There's two reasons of drastically unequal importance. The unimportant reason, or the less important reason, is that it's often more convenient to use scientific notation. Here it's not. 12 is a lot easier to write than 1.2 times 10 to the 1, right? But often in science, we're dealing with huge numbers or tiny numbers. Like Avogadro's number. That's a huge number. 6.022 times 10 to the 23rd. If you use standard notation, it's 602 and then 22 more zeros. That's a pain in the ass to work with, right? So that's one reason to use, and the same for very small numbers. Instead of writing 0.0000 until you get to the non-zero number, you write it in scientific notation. The one reason, in other words, is shorthand notation. But there's a much more important reason we use it. And that's because of numbers like 150, or ones that have trailing zeros. If you look at them in standard notation, you don't know how many significant figures there are. 12, we know, has two, because it's both non-zero numbers. But 150, 150, we don't know whether it's two or three. 1500, we don't know whether it's two, three, or four, right? So that's the more important reason to use scientific notation. 150 in standard notation is 150. If there are two, if you know that there are two significant figures in there, then in scientific notation it would be 1.5 times 10 to the second power. If instead there are actually three in 150, three significant figures, then you would write it as 1.50 times 10 to the second. And here's where we erase the ambiguity. Whatever number you have written in scientific notation, whatever comes before the times 10, the number part here, doesn't matter whether it's zeros or not. However many digits there are, they're all significant. So by looking at this 1.5 times 10 squared, we know by looking at this that there are exactly two significant figures, not three. This, on the other hand, has three, not two. To a calculator, those are the same number, but they have different numbers of significant figures, which is an issue of resolution that I'll talk about in just a minute. I'm getting close to being done, though. Okay, now, usually at this point, I ask you whether this dimensional analysis process makes sense, and invariably everyone says yes, because that really means I want to get the hell out of here, so I'm going to say yes, I understand this, I can do this on my own. Then a week later, they get close to a zero on the quiz. So I'm going to force you to sit through another example to do the same process, just using a different problem. This time, let's make the step between systems again, but do it in the opposite direction. So if I say 67.4 gigameters equals how many feet? That's a conversion problem, right? What is the first step in all cases? Write down what you have, which is what? What is it? 67.4 gigameters. That's a capital G. Make it a fraction by putting it over 1. Automatically make yourself an empty fraction. You need to get rid of the gigameters, right? They're upstairs now. Put them downstairs to get rid of them. Notice that gigameters is somewhere in the metric system. We're going to try to make the leap from metric to silly, so we want to take advantage of that centimeter inch thing, right? But pay attention to what I told you before. While you're still new to the metric system, don't go directly to it. Instead, go to where you are, which is gigameters, to the base, which is meters. And if you look at the tables, you might not have giga memorized, but kilo you probably know is 1,000, right? Mega is 1,000,000. Three orders of magnitude bigger than kilo. Giga is three more orders of magnitude up, so it's 1,000,000,000. So it is by far the bigger unit. Therefore, it gets the smaller number, right? 1 gigameter, since giga means 1,000,000,000 of, is equal to 1,000,000,000 meters, which I'm just going to write as 10 to the ninth. I could write it as 1 followed by 9 zeros, but it's a shorthand. If I stopped there, I would be in meters. I have to be in feet. But I went to the base so that I can now then go to the base to where I want to be, not ultimately where I want to be, which is feet, but to centimeters, because that allows me to use that centimeters to inches one. Okay? So go from meters now to get rid of those to centimeters. The smaller unit gets the bigger number. That takes 100 centimeters to equal 1 meter. Meters and gigameters are now canceled. We're left with centimeters, but now we can do the trick of going from metric to silly by using centimeters to inches. It's always 2.54 exactly centimeters for 1 inch. So now it's downstairs because we're using the same thing in reverse, right? Before the 2.54 was upstairs, but that doesn't matter. It's always with the centimeters, wherever the centimeters are. It's smaller than an inch, so the centimeters should be more than 1 inch. Okay, now that we're in the silly system, we can go from inches to anywhere we know. I want feet. So do you have one that we could use directly for inches to feet? Yes, you can use 12 inches to 1 foot, right? And so that tells you that you've set this up properly, because everything except what the answer is supposed to be in is canceled. Every unit, that is canceled. So, someone put this in a calculator, properly hitting equals once. But while you're doing that, someone who isn't doing the calculator, tell me how many significant figures are we allowed to use in the answer? Is that a 2 or 3? 3. Why do you say 3? I mean, this number looks like it only has 2, but this is exact, just like 2.54 is exact. So it's a billion, but it could be a billion point zero, as many as you want. You're right. This is the only thing that's uncertain, or non-infinite in terms of significant figures. So yeah, we can't have more than three. We have to have three exactly. The calculator is going to spit out a lot more, but you need to round it to three, to the third number. What is the number, by the way? Yeah, anything. I think he's getting close right now. You have it yet? I can't hear that. What's the, what are it? 2, 2, 1. Yeah, but just dealing in numbers first. Okay, so that's already more than you're allowed to have, right? This is the fourth one. We use it to determine how we round. It's below 5, so all we have are 2, 2, 1. Now, is it expressing this in scientific notation, or?
Yeah.
Okay, what's the exponent? To the 11th. So it's 2.21 times 10 to the 11th power. That's the magnitude, so we're still not done. You have to add the units, which is feet. And we're still not done. The final step in these is just a mental step, but it's one that you shouldn't forget. It's simply to ask yourself, does this answer make sense? What we have here is a huge number, right? 221 billion feet. Does that make sense? Well, think about what you started with. 67 gigameters. 67 billion meters. That's a huge distance, right? So it should make sense, expressed in feet, that it's a hell of a big number. If it's 0.0003, you've done something wrong. So bother to ask yourself whether it makes sense. But taking the time to write all the units properly means that you probably do have the right answer. Right? It proves that you've set it up properly. So now, are you going to tell me again that you can do this on your own? Or that you will be able to within a week? Okay, that leaves only one more thing. It's actually three things. It's three definitions. It's unrelated to dimensional analysis, really. I want to distinguish between accuracy, precision, and resolution. Now, what about accuracy? What would be a good definition of that? Yeah.
How close something is to a, like, set a target?
Yeah, how close to the truth a measurement is, for instance, or a value is. So any given quantity has a specific correct size, right? Whether you ever get to that absolute truth is another thing, but accuracy is how close your measurement is to the true value. And I'm glad you said target, because that's how often textbooks show you analogy of this. They use a dartboard as an analogy. The center of the dartboard represents the true value. And the throwing of a dart represents the taking of a measurement. Right? Might not hit that center of the board, but the closer it is, the more accurate it is. That's a single measurement. Next is precision, which doesn't really make sense unless you're talking about multiple measurements. Precision has to do with repeatability. Right, you can keep putting the same object on a scale and weighing it over and over. That's multiple measurements, right? Well, if you have a scale that has high precision, it will give you the same value over and over, or very close to the same value each time you measure it. In the dartboard analogy, it's like throwing multiple darts, because you're taking multiple measurements, right? Well, I'm playing darts at a bar drunk, I might throw three darts that don't hit the board at all, just land in the wall somewhere. If they happen to land very tightly together, they're nowhere near accurate, but that would be high precision because you're getting the same measurement over and over. And in an instrument case, you know, if you have a bathroom scale that is way off, you might weigh the same thing every time you stand on it, but it's nowhere near what you really weigh. So you can have high precision even though you have low accuracy. Obviously, you would like to have high precision and high accuracy. And you can even have high accuracy with low precision. In the dartboard analogy, that would be, I'm nowhere near the bullseye. I make a triangle all along the edge. But if you average those out, it would be right in the middle. Low precision but high accuracy, kind of rare. But it's obviously good to have high precision and high accuracy. The remaining one is resolution. And I've already been talking about this when I was talking about significant figures. Resolution is the noun form of resolve. And resolve, to resolve is another word for to discriminate. To discriminate means to tell the difference between things. So, by analogy, we can talk about two marks on a wall. If I make two black marks with a marker on a wall, if I stand close enough to the wall, I can easily tell that they are distinct marks. I can, in other words, discriminate them from each other, or I can resolve them. Okay, I can tell the difference. Yeah, go ahead.
Precision, how would you write that down?
Repeatability. Yeah, getting the same values over repeated measurements of the same things.
Okay.
If I have a big enough room and I stand back farther and farther, eventually I will get to a distance where even though I know there are two marks, it will look to my eyes like it's one mark. In other words, I've lost the ability to resolve them. This is what happens when you have pixelation. For instance, on American television, where they don't want to show a naked breast, they'll pixelate it, right? So you can't really see any detail anymore. It's just those boxes. Well, each of those boxes is really many points inside it, but you've lost that resolution. You can't tell them apart anymore. So, yeah, go ahead.
So resolution is not being able to tell the difference between things?
Well, resolving is the ability to tell the difference.
Okay.
High resolution means that you can tell things that are very close still apart from each other.
Okay.
And it doesn't have to be close in space. Resolution in numerical terms refers to how far you can go in decimal places, basically. And that's why I was using the word resolution when I said significant figures. If you have 150, because you've measured 150 miles, well, if you use a long measuring tape, but it only has tick marks 10 feet apart and not closer together, then you can only resolve to the nearest 10 feet. And that's why only 1 in 5 would be significant and not the 0. But if you have a tape that has tick mark for every foot, then you can resolve to the foot. See what I'm saying there? And therefore, 1, 5, and 0 are all significant in that case. Now, another example of resolution also involves a bathroom scale. If I tell you to get on a bathroom scale and tell me your weight, you'll give me whatever the number is. And I'll say, okay, now stay on the scale. I'm going to hand you this postage stamp. I want you to tell me the combined weight of you and the stamp. Well, a typical American bathroom scale isn't going to be able to resolve the difference, right? So you'll give me the same number. Even though that stamp does have weight, you can't tell it with that instrument. But if you have a couple grams of salt on a high resolution balance in a laboratory, it'll tell you what the weight is. If you add that postage stamp, it'll drastically go up. It'll be able to resolve it. Is that all clear? In that case, I'm more than satisfied speaking. My voice is going, so we're done for today. Oh, except I want to hand out some practice metric system sheets. Practice does mean that it's optional. It's not graded. It's just giving you some problems to practice these if you want to do it. Oh, did I give you both? Sorry. But importantly, since the bookstore is out of the lab manual, I'm going to have to be posting the stuff you're going to need this week before we meet again, because you won't have your manual. It might take until tomorrow morning before that's up, but make sure you keep an eye on the website anyway, because you need to check for announcements each day. Anything unclear about how we do things in the course? Alrighty. Oh, one thing I forgot, which you're reminding me of, is that you can never have any food or drink sitting at your table. So you either put it in a bag or you can put it on the shelf. If you do put it on the shelf, don't forget to take it with you. If you forget, though, there are 181 labs in here all day. It won't be me here, but you can come in and get it. But also, if instead of putting it in your bag, you put your water over here, I will let you come over here and take a drink from it here as long as you put it back. You can't drink at your table, though. Did I give you both?
Yes,
you need lavender?
Yes, I do.
Oh, damn. I didn't stop the recording. It's going to be a boring end.